The legendary physicist Richard Feynman once proposed a concept that honestly at the time sounded like pure science fiction.
Oh, absolutely. It was way out there.
Right. He looked at a ribosome, and for you listening, that's a tiny structure inside a cell, and he didn't just see like a biological blob doing its thing. He saw a machine.
A literal functional machine.
Exactly. A machine that utilizes what we now call protein domain dynamics. He suggested that if we could truly understand those mechanical wiggles, the bending, the hinging, the tiny physical movements of these massive molecular complexes, we could actually harness them.
We could engineer them.
Yeah, engineer them to do our own heavy lifting. Welcome to this deep dive, by the way. Today, we are exploring the massive, wildly ambitious world of biological engineering.
And it is a massive world.
It really is. Our mission today is to uncover how humans are taking the hardcore, rigid tools of traditional engineering and, well, applying them to the squishy, seemingly chaotic world of living biology and doing it to create usable, economically viable products.
Which is such a wild shift. Because for decades, Feynman's vision was just trapped in the realm of theory. We simply didn't have the observational tools to see a machine that small actually in motion.
But that barrier is gone now.
It is entirely gone. Today, using highly advanced techniques, like neutron spin echo spectroscopy, we can actually watch the machine at work.
Neutron spin echo spectroscopy, that sounds
It
intense.
is a mouthful, yeah. But think of it like a highly sophisticated molecular radar.
Okay, I can picture that.
So we bounce a beam of polarized neutrons off these biological molecules, and then we measure the slight changes in their spin when they scatter back.
Wow, so you're tracking the echo, basically.
Right, exactly. It lets us measure the rapid, real-time mechanical bending of a protein. We are literally watching the gears turn.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. It's as if we've been handed the ultimate multi-billion-year-old operating system nature itself, and after centuries of just, marveling at the code, we're finally learning how to write our own apps for it.
That is the perfect analogy. And that shift in perspective is what makes this field so powerful. To write those apps, we have to move past traditional biology.
Because historically, biology was just an observational science, right?
Right? You look at an organism, you poke it, you describe its behavior. But biological engineering is the literal marriage of pure and applied sciences with living tissue.
Which sounds completely contradictory.
It does. We are taking the foundational mathematical principles of engineering, things like mass and heat transfer, fluid mechanics, thermodynamics, polymer science.
And you're forcing them to shake hands with living cells.
Exactly.
I'm struggling to see the connective tissue there, though. I mean, if you look at classical mechanics or circuit design, you are dealing with predictable static materials like steel or copper.
Very stable materials, yeah.
But a living cell has, what, millions of chaotic variables interacting simultaneously. How do you apply rigid thermodynamic math to something that dynamic without the whole model just falling apart?
Well, it requires a massive leap in how we measure energy. Biological systems, despite all their chaos, are still physical systems.
Okay.
They are still bound by the laws of physics and chemistry. A cell metabolizing glucose is still exchanging heat and energy.
So it's still doing the math, just really quietly.
Exactly. The genius of the biological engineer is isolating those variables well enough to make the math work on a microscopic scale.
Can you give me an example of what that looks like?
Sure. So, say you want to engineer a bacterium to produce an industrial chemical instead of its normal waste products.
Like turning it into a tiny factory.
Right. You have to rewrite its metabolic pathways to do that. And you do that by tracking the exact energy states, the thermodynamics of those new chemical reactions.
How do you even track heat from a single bacteria?
Bioengineers use techniques like microcalorimetry. It measures the minuscule heat output of these cellular processes.
Microcalorimetry, wow.
Yeah, they aren't just crossing their fingers. They are calculating the exact energy flux required to optimize that specific chemical yield.
So we're moving from observing nature to predicting and controlling it. The goal is to mimic, modify, or augment these systems to create tangible end products.
Very tangible.
We're talking about bacteria specifically designed to eat pollutants, portable, rapid disease diagnostic devices, biopharmaceuticals, even tissue-engineered organs.
And achieving that level of control took decades of trial and error. I mean, the desire to merge machines with biology isn't a uniquely 21st century phenomenon.
Right. If you look at the timeline, the seeds were planted way before World War II. But the post-war era is where the acceleration really happened, didn't it?
Yeah, the 1950s brought this massive technological boom in electronics.
Right, and in 1954, there was this British scientist and broadcaster named Heinz Wolff.
Yes, Heinz Wolff.
He actually coined the term bioengineering while working at the National Institute for Medical Research. And he later went on to become the director of the Division of Biological Engineering at Oxford.
Which was a huge deal. That was a major milestone for getting the discipline recognized at the university level.
But when you look at what they were actually doing in the 50s, it looks nothing like what we're talking about today.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They were basically treating the human body like a wet, complicated radio.
A wet radio. That's a great way to put it.
I mean, early bioengineering was essentially just electrical engineering applied in a hospital setting. They were building medical monitors, early pacemakers, imaging equipment.
So it was all about applying external wires and metal to flesh.
Exactly. They were measuring outputs, but they weren't altering the biological mechanisms.
Because they couldn't. And that's where they hit a massive wall, right?
The huge wall.
You had this bunch of highly trained electrical engineers who realized they were trying to fix a biological car without knowing what the engine was.
Yeah, they were building devices for a system they just couldn't fully comprehend.
And they literally had to go back to school. They had to study biology, psychology, and medicine just to bridge the gap.
Which completely fractured the traditional academic model at the time. You suddenly had engineers admitting, hey, we can't just force a machine onto a biological system.
The machine has to speak the language.
Right. It had to speak the chemical and physical language of the human body. You had to understand the fluid dynamics of blood before you could build a better artificial heart valve.
That makes total sense. And that friction basically birthed the modern educational foundation of the field.
It did. By 1966, the first official biological engineering program in the United States was launched at the University of California, San Diego.
And from there, the academic world had to catch up rapidly. Programs launched at MIT, Utah State University, all across the globe, which kind of brings us to the sheer scale of the field today.
The scale is staggering.
According to MIT professor Doug Laufenberger, biological engineering operates on a spectrum of size that is almost hard to wrap your head around. It doesn't just stop at the cellular level.
No, the spectrum is vast. I mean, when we think of traditional engineering, we usually picture things at human scale.
Right. Bridges, combustion engines, skyscrapers.
Exactly. But biological engineering starts at the absolute microscopic molecular level. We're dealing with DNA, protein chemistry, immunology, pharmacology.
The invisible stuff.
The invisible stuff. Then it scales up to cellular and tissue-based systems, like building living biosensors.
Okay.
Then it scales up again to macroscopic organisms like whole plants and animals.
And it goes all the way up to entire biomes, which blew my mind. We're talking about environmental modifications using biological engineering for surface soil protection.
Slope stabilization, shoreline protection.
Yeah, windbreaks. Many traditional agricultural engineering departments across the globe have actually rebranded themselves. They're now agricultural and biological engineering.
Or biosystems engineering, yeah.
But let me push back on that scale for a second because it seems contradictory.
How so?
Well, if I'm designing a microscopic biosensor, I'm working with proteins and lab equipment. But if I'm stabilizing a shoreline, I'm working with ocean tides, soil mechanics, and massive ecosystems. Are we really saying those two people are using the exact same engineering logic?
We are. It comes down to systems thinking. And the foundational logic is remarkably similar.
Really?
Yeah. Whether you are looking at the flow of a single protein across a cell membrane or the flow of nitrogen across an entire agricultural valley, you are fundamentally dealing with mass transfer.
Mass transfer. Okay, so it's inputs and outputs.
Exactly. You are looking at inputs, outputs, environmental constraints, and system equilibrium. Think about agricultural runoff.
Okay, the fertilizer getting into the rivers.
Right. If you view an entire river basin through the lens of fluid mechanics and chemical kinetics, you can engineer biological interventions.
Like what kind of intervention?
Like targeted bacterial mats or modified root systems. Things that process those excess nutrients before they destroy the ecosystem downstream.
Wow. So the bioengineer's superpower is basically the ability to zoom in and out.
That's exactly it.
Which perfectly explains why the education to become one of these engineers is so brutal.
Oh, it's intense.
A student pursuing a Bachelor of Science in this field typically spends 3 to 5 years juggling a curriculum that sounds like a paradox. They are sitting in a classroom learning genetic engineering and enzyme kinetics.
And then walking across the hall to study mechanical dynamics, thermodynamics, and electronics.
They have to speak both languages fluently.
And when they finally graduate and enter the real world, they step into a landscape of subdisciplines that are fundamentally reshaping our relationship with the natural world.
Let's dive into those subdisciplines, actually, because this feels like stepping into nature's R&D department.
It really does.
The first one is biomimetics. This is all about imitating models, systems, and elements of nature to solve complex human problems.
And there's a very famous example of this.
Yes, the classic example is Velcro. So George de Mestral was out walking his dog, and he noticed how stubbornly little plant burrs stuck to his dog's hair.
Right, they just wouldn't come out.
Exactly. So he put those burrs under a microscope, saw the tiny hook and loop structure, and just engineered a synthetic version. So we're basically letting evolution do the heavy lifting for millions of years, and then we just swoop in, copy the homework, and file the patent.
I mean, it's a funny way to phrase it, but there's a serious efficiency argument there.
It's efficient stealing.
Well, we aren't just being lazy. We're recognizing that human engineering is fundamentally limited by our short iteration cycles.
That's true. We haven't been doing this for billions of years.
Exactly. Evolution has spent billions of years stress testing designs for durability, aerodynamics, energy conservation. Biomimetics is about recognizing that nature has already solved the physics problem. We just have to translate that biological solution into synthetic materials.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, if biomimetics is borrowing nature's blueprints, then bioprinting is basically using nature's ink.
Yes, utilizing biomaterials to literally print cells, tissues, and potentially entire organs.
But the challenge there isn't just squirting cells out of a nozzle, right?
Yeah, far from it. The real engineering hurdle in bioprinting isn't just stacking the cells, it's keeping them alive.
Because they need blood.
Right. If you 3D print a solid chunk of liver tissue, the cells on the outside might survive, but the cells in the center will immediately suffocate and die.
Oh, wow. Because they have no blood supply.
Exactly. So biological engineers have to simultaneously print a microscopic, fully functional vascular network.
Tiny artificial capillary.
Yeah, embedded right within the tissue. They use specialized bioinks that hold their structural shape long enough for the cells to bind together.
While still letting nutrients flow through.
Exactly, allowing nutrients to flow through the tissue the thumbnail it's printed.
That is incredible. And it naturally bleeds into biorobotics, because instead of just printing static organs, we are combining advanced electronics with biological materials to create things that move.
This is where it gets really sci-fi.
It does. We're talking about prosthetics that interface directly with the human nervous system, interpreting electrical signals from the brain to move robotic fingers, or even wilder biohybrid robots.
Biohybrid robots are a perfect illustration of treating biology as a mechanical component.
How do they even work?
Engineers are literally taking living muscle tissue, usually grown in a lab, and attaching it to synthetic 3D printed skeletons.
Wait, really? Living muscle on a plastic skeleton?
Yes. By stimulating that muscle tissue with electrical impulses, the muscle contracts and moves the robotic skeleton.
It's a machine powered by living cellular engines.
It bridges the gap between organic life and synthetic robotics in a way that Heinz Wolff could only have dreamed of back in 1954.
But biological engineering isn't just about healthcare or, you know, building biocyborgs. There's a massive application in environmental health engineering, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Applying these principles to control the environment for human survival. And I don't just mean building a better air conditioner. We are talking about life support systems for the extremes of human exploration.
Like outer space.
Outer space, the bottom of the ocean.
Right. When you put a human in a tin can in the vacuum of space, you essentially have to bioengineer a closed-loop ecosystem from scratch.
Because you can't just open a window.
You definitely can't open a window.
Yeah.
Earth's biosphere naturally recycles air, purifies water, and processes waste through massive interconnected biological cycles.
So in a spacecraft, you have to shrink all of that down.
You have to recreate that entire planetary process within a few cubic meters. You engineer biological reactors utilizing specific algae or bacteria that scrub carbon dioxide from the air, produce oxygen, and break down human waste into usable water and nutrients.
Wow.
You are mathematically balancing the metabolic inputs and outputs of the crew with the metabolic inputs and outputs of your engineered microbiome.
It's basically a highly controlled, high-stakes terrarium.
That's a great way to look at it.
Which ties perfectly into biochemical engineering and bioprocess engineering. This is where we get into fermentation and utilizing microscopic systems to synthesize entirely new products.
Right, turning vats of microbes into microscopic factories.
To produce biopharmaceuticals, specialized proteins, or bioenergy. But again, you can't just throw yeast in a bucket and hope for the best.
Not at an industrial scale. This isn't a backyard brewery. We are talking about massive, multi-thousand-liter bioreactors. At that scale, the sheer fluid, sheer stress from the mechanical mixing blades could literally rip the cell walls of your microbes apart.
Oh, man. So you could just blend your own factory by accident.
Exactly. You have to calculate the perfect fluid dynamics to keep the mixture homogeneous without destroying your biological factories. You need the temperature, the dissolved oxygen levels, and the pH to be absolutely perfect throughout the entire tank.
So much precise math.
It requires incredibly precise thermodynamic and fluid control, which brings us right back to the beginning of our discussion, really, applying strict physical math to living organisms.
It really is a full circle moment. We've taken you listening on a massive journey today, starting from Richard Feynman staring at the mechanical gears of a ribosome, all the way to electrical engineers in the 50s realizing they needed to crack open a biology textbook.
It's been a long road.
We've moved from printing vascular networks to designing living life support systems for astronauts. But a field with this much power, the power to literally rewrite the physical and genetic code of living things, it requires serious organizational infrastructure.
And that infrastructure is what keeps the field moving forward safely and systematically.
Like ABET, right.
Yes, the Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology. They are the ones rigorously evaluating and accrediting these intense multidisciplinary university programs.
Making sure the students actually know what they're doing.
Exactly. They ensure that the next generation of engineers actually has the dual mastery of biology and physics required to do this work without causing catastrophic system failures.
And then you have organizations focusing on the broader impact, like the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering, AMBE, and the Institute of Biological Engineering, IBE.
And their role is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because they aren't the ones in the lab coats pipetting fluids or building the biohybrid robots.
Right. They aren't doing the direct research.
No. Their primary mission is public education, advocacy, and the overall advancement of the field. They exist to translate the value of biological engineering to policymakers and the public.
They offer scholarships to promising students, recognize incredible innovations, and basically build the societal framework that allows this research to continue.
They are crucial for maintaining public trust, ensuring people understand that this discipline is built on careful, mathematically calculated engineering principles.
Which is so important because this field is blurring the lines of reality every single day. I mean, we are building machines out of muscle and using cells as factories. So to wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with something to chew on.
We've talked extensively about applying rigorous engineering math to biology to create machines. And we've talked about using billions of years of biological evolution to inspire our engineering.
Yeah.
So as we get better at bioprinting functional organs, as we build more sophisticated biohybrid robots that run on living tissue, and as we program synthetic cells to manage our ecosystems, think about this.
Okay.
In the next few decades, will there even be a meaningful distinction left between a biological organism and a manufactured machine?
A completely wild thought to end on. If nature is the ultimate operating system, it looks like we're not just writing apps anymore. We're starting to build our own hardware. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you. Keep looking at the hidden mechanics and everything, and we'll see you next time.
Imagine you are standing in this really prominent 17th century laboratory.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. And the highly respected scientist standing in front of you has just proposed a genuinely wild theory. I mean, he claims that invisible forces can reach across millions of miles of completely empty space, you know, just to pull massive objects toward each other.
Wow. With, like, no physical mechanism at all.
Exactly. There are no ropes, no physical gears, just this invisible pull. And he is immediately criticized by his peers. I mean, they call his theory ridiculous. They actually call it occult magic.
That's just wild to think about today.
It really is, because that scientist was Isaac Newton. And his magic was gravity.
It completely shatters the image we usually have, doesn't it? I mean, when you hear the word occult, you don't typically think of the foundational figures of modern physics.
Right, definitely.